Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. My name's Travis Dow.
And I'm Pete Coleman from the Bohemican podcast.
Today's person of note is Francis Bacon. And at the age of 20, he became a member of Parliament. At the age of 42, he was knighted for his service to King James, becoming Sir Francis Bacon. At the age of 52, he was appointed England's Attorney General. At the age of 56, he reached the top by becoming the Lord High Chancellor of England.
But Travis, who was Francis Bacon and what warranted his rise to the top echelons of government? Well, let's take a look at this background and his early life before delving into his theories and what makes him interesting for this History of Alchemy podcast. Let's just burrow right on into this. Francis Bacon was instrumental in developing the scientific method, but as we'll see in tonight's podcast, he was still very much in the world where alchemy existed and was possible. So he helped end the world of alchemy and ranted against astrology and magic, even if he thought transmutating gold was possible.
And Francis Bacon, this is pretty neat because he was homeschooled until about 12. And I guess the school system, we've seen this many times before. The school system was very different back in the early 17th century or late 16th century, rather. Because at the age of 12, after being homeschooled, he was granted admission to the Trinity College in Cambridge. And his medieval curriculum was taught mainly in Latin. So that's kind of, that's kind of different. That's like middle school age. And instead of that, you go to Trinity College. So Elizabeth I once called him the young Lord Keeper. His studies at Cambridge led him to believe that the methods and results of science studied at that time were completely wrong. So already, like, this young 12-year-old was like, no, wait. This is crap. Now, he claimed to like Aristotle, but we'll see that, not all of it. And he claimed to be strongly against his beliefs and referred to them as unprofitable, argumentative, and incorrect. He and his brother, Anthony, entered De Societate Magistrorum on July 27th, 1576. That's the first date I'll mention. Late 16th century. From there, he went to France while his brother returned home.
Now, while in France under Henry III, Bacon gained valuable political instruction. He studied languages and civil law while delivering diplomatic letters to England from Walsingham, Berkeley, which happens to be Bacon's uncle, and Leicester, as well as Queen Elizabeth I herself. You know, we did a podcast on her, Travis, and one of the other and the others in her court and contemporaries. This is the time of Rudolf II, and after all, another piece of the puzzle mentioned in the Rudifying book that we are putting together right now. As a matter of fact, we're actually putting these pieces together in one of our latest endeavors, Travis. So just a little plug for the book that's eventually coming out.
It might be that the book's already out, depending on when you're hearing this and when this comes out. So check the website. There might be a book about Rudolfine Prague and this time period. But anyways,
So in 1579, his father suddenly died. So you can imagine what that would have done for somebody that was homeschooled. And of course, you're talking about your place in society and basically your anchor, most likely, for Bacon. He was once quoted as saying that his three reasons for being were to uncover the truth, serve his country, and serve the church. He once applied for a position in the court through his uncle, Burghley, but this was denied. He was later admitted as an outer barrister in 1582. He took a seat for Parliament for Malcolm in Dorset in 1584 and then for Taunton in 1586. So this was the time in which Bacon began writing the now lost tract called Temporis Partus Maximus, believed to have been about philosophical reform. So you could talk about this guy is really in the forefront of really taking in what he thought he knew, but also really railing against what was taught in schools. So, really a very interesting time for Bacon.
So later in life, we're describing a political career here because that's what he's mostly known for is his rise to power in the upper echelons of the British government. He served King James. He became Sir Francis Bacon, like we said, and at age 45, he married Alice Barnham, who was still a few days shy of being 14.
Wow. 14. Okay. I guess those were the days when you had to marry early, right, Trav? So that would be a little shocking today, but maybe back then that was somewhat common.
Yeah, there's some people that talk smack against him, and it's hard to say what the deal was, but some even said that he preferred guys. Maybe you just never know. Cause at that time that was considered like a huge insult, but yeah, like they would cite his close relationship with King James as an example and his rise to power saying like, oh, something like he slept his way to the top kind of thing. So yeah. Okay. Anyways, I mean, that's a weird theory. And then you add that he actually married she was 13 still at their wedding day and she became 14. But yeah, anyway, so, but that's kind of how it was, even though, so that's a 30-year gap. I mean, I don't, it's hard to defend that. Even just saying, it was 1600, it was 1620.
Sure. Well, people had a life expectancy might have been a little bit less than, of course, we have today. So you might have to get moving a little earlier. But, you know, there were some evidence, though, the Bacon that had really declared his love for this young woman in the forms of poems that he had, and mm-hmm. and the courtship was really flourishing for him and Alice. And as things were coming up to their first anniversary, but I'll tell you though, after the honeymoon period, things started kind of unraveling a little bit. People started talking about things in the street and saying, "Hey, you know what? We think that she might be actually having a secret relationship with a John Underhill." And Bacon eventually took her out of his will because he really kind of bought into these discussions behind his back. And there was also some folks who suspected that he preferred the same sex as you said, Travis, citing his very close relationship with King James. But
and I wonder about
these things do happen. Mudslinging,
That's the thing.
You talk about being in politics. Yeah.
Isaac Newton had the same thing said about it. Isaac Newton, I kind of believe it more, maybe, I guess. But because to his apprentice. Right.
There's some scholars that say that.
Yeah. Okay. And in any case, what's more interesting for us for the podcast, to bring it back to, why we're even here, is that in 1620, I want to talk about his philosophy, basically. And in 1620, he started to develop a method for philosophers. And the reason I emphasize the word method is because what he's most known for, especially after his death, is you could call him the father of the scientific method. He wanted everybody to be on the same foot when furthering knowledge. And he even started to call things like the scientific method. So, but yeah, he wanted a method for philosophers to use in weighing the value of knowledge. And so, I mean, he agreed with Aristotle. He disagreed with Aristotle in a lot of ways, but he agreed that humans can err in their five senses. And yeah, but yet this is how most of us learn. And, this is like most of us trust our senses and that's how we know things. But yeah, so, but Francis Bacon also said that he believed there must be doubt. We must doubt everything until we can kind of prove it. And this is kind of science in the way that he himself might have not made any huge discoveries, but just like the philosophy of how you make discoveries in his works after his death, this is what actually makes him more famous.
The scientific method. Yeah. Right. And you can see this, that the idea of deconstructing what you know is something that he was dabbling with as a young man going through his education, and then saying, I'm going to place doubt on everything that I think I know. And therefore, I'm going to prove those things. We're going to start from ground zero, and we're going to work our way up from even the most basic constructs. And so, you know, using this scientific method allows you to do this deconstruction and to re-piece things back together. So just in case you miss something, that you might even have a different take on what we consider to be, you know, fact. And in the sense of science. So very, very interesting. We're talking the 17th century. Must have been mind-blowing for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about the scientific method, this is – we put people in camps, at least on the show, of like pro-Aristotle, anti-Aristotle, pro-Paracelsus, anti-Paracelsus. And he was kind of – I mean, he's in the anti-Aristotle camp for the most part. He's in the anti-Paracelsus camp in the most part. But not entirely, and he's often known as the father of empiricism in a way, but we don't want to like – Well, I mean, like, we've talked about other people on the show, like Ibn Hayyan, like Jabir, that were kind of in the same camp. Like, they argued for experimentation and for, like, empirical knowledge in that way. But he does get this reputation. Francis Bacon definitely gets the reputation of being the father of the scientific method. There's an interesting side note. Some people believe that Shakespeare's work was actually written by Bacon, but that Bacon chose to remain anonymous because of his political aspirations. You know, so he didn't want to be seen as like a playwright. Because, you know, what do you think about that? Have you heard that?
Well, I think it'd be a little more confusing in the sense that you're saying that Bacon sort of wrote something but may have not wrote it, when possibly, as we may know today, that Shakespeare may not have written some of the things we thought Shakespeare had written. So, you know, you have Bacon saying that I didn't touch the stuff for Shakespeare, or I did, if Shakespeare existed in the sense of the playwright that we know today. Interesting in the sense that no one really wants to cite themselves as a fact of being a playwright. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of people, you know, doing ghost writing and having nom de plumes and those type of things. And maybe even Shakespeare borrowed some of his sonnets from other writers. It's just really confusing.
Shakespeare just had the name. So it was like, okay, well, you know, here's a great play, but I'd rather be Lord High Chancellor. So you take this, you know, you publish it and get the credit.
So, Trev, before we kind of dive in more as a review of his philosophical sort of standard, let's talk about how he wrapped up his corporeal life, as we say, right? His time on the top was very, very short. At the age of 60, he was believed to be insanely greedy, and rather than spread wealth among the people, he was believed that he wished nothing more than to acquire tons for himself. Maybe a Scrooge McDuck, if you will, for those of us that a more popular take on that, right? He was investigated for bribe taking and corruption. We talked about his political aspirations, so that probably was par for the course. Eventually pleading guilty to this through stating that although he had taken bribes, he had applied the law correctly. So sort of agreeing that I did it.
Yeah, it's like, is it like no contest? My role. It's like, I did it, but it was fine. Yeah.
Everybody else is doing it, right? So for these charges, he was fined a great deal of money and forced to spend a short period of time in prison. The fine was eventually waived, but he was denied the opportunity to serve in any more governmental positions and lost his government pension. So you can imagine the hard times falling upon Bacon later in life. Mm-hmm. As we approach his death, it was a result of exposure to the elements. Boy, is that ironic! I'm talking about his viewpoint let's go back to this for a second, because that is really interesting, actually, to Travis, because one of the things he was talking about when proving tests for truths or hypotheses when you're talking about the scientific method, he had devised a method in which scientists set up experiments to manipulate nature and attempt to prove these truths to be false. So, for example, in order to prove that his sicknesses came from external causes, Bacon argues that scientists should expose healthy people to outside influences such as coldness, wetness, and or other sick people. So flash forward back to what we just said about how he died. of exposure to the elements. Okay, so I guess full circle, right?
Yeah.
Bacon became inspired to carry out these experiments on food preservations by freezing a chicken. And he had developed a cough from this low temperature conditions, and his health really started to deteriorate very quickly. He dies of pneumonia at the age of 65, doing pretty much what he loved, trying to really investigate the scientific method. Freezing chicken.
He likes to freeze doing what he loves, freezing chickens. and so he died. Oh, my God. Yeah, but yeah, that's right. He died from – I love it, actually. I was like, wow, you're really setting this up, like that he died from freezing a chicken. But no, I love the way you set it up that actually, yeah, he died, running experiments. Like that is kind of like poetic in a way. As a politician even, and as his love for science, he kind of called for this society, if you will, that would kind of research things and – I'm just trying not to say the Royal Society, because basically he called for the Royal Society before it was founded, and this was kind of, you know, because it was founded in 1660, and this was, yeah, originally, you know, the Royal Society is like super, we've brought it up dozens of times, kind of a gentleman's club for, tinkering aristocrats that would like to sit around and talk about natural philosophy, or is that, I don't know if that's accurate or not, that's how I imagine it. Or his work called The Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society is believed to be the first scientific journal. But yeah, it's part of the movement that really changed the world when the scientific revolution gave way to the industrial revolution. And this is we're not there yet, because Francis Bacon did still believe in alchemy. Yeah, he did kind of rediscover pre-Socratic philosophers, especially one that I'll bring up because we did a episode on him and pseudo him, which is Democritus and the old atomic theory. And this also kind of gives us a strange paradox, or I don't know, a contrast where and the reason we're talking about him on the show is that Francis Bacon did believe alchemy was possible while ranting against, like, criticizing Renaissance alchemy, magic, astrology, all that stuff. But yeah, saying that, okay, alchemy was possible, but just very, very difficult. Like clearly it's possible because of the elements, and you can manipulate, and transmutation is possible. But it's just very difficult. Even went so far as to say that, you know, transmutating gold is more difficult than transmutating silver. So that's neat that even that the father of the scientific method, still lived in a world where even this rational being thought alchemy, like you could transmutate gold.
So as we see in Bacon's life, we see him breaking away from the past. Travis, we talked about how he was looking at the alchemical past of his forefathers and saying, okay, what we need to do to kind of usher in a new line of thought through the way of thinking with science as a foundation. And part of that is leaving behind the idols, you know, the idols of you know, pagan scientific belief systems.
Yeah.
Things we used to think of in our caveman Stone Age days. We need to leave those idols behind and move forward to the things that we can think about today, you know, free us from those idols. And one of the very interesting quotes that we have here from Bacon warns the student of empirical science not to tackle the complexities of his subject without purging the mind of its idols. And quote unquote, this is what Bacon had to say. On waxen tablets, you cannot write anything new until you rub out the old. With the mind, it is not so. There, you cannot rub out the old until you have written in the new. Mm-hmm. Deep thoughts by Sir Bacon.
Francis Bacon. He's like, let's move on. Let's learn new stuff and get rid of our old way of thinking. And yeah. Just to give some examples here, some of his idols are, and in his writings, you have like the idols of the tribe, the idols of the cave. And he was really thinking like the old way of thinking. Okay. And the idols of the tribe, where like this our understanding of what it is to be human is kind of crooked. Like maybe, I don't know, to put it in modern terms, like maybe we see it through our own culture and our own, fellow man, and not like empirically from a bird's eye view, so to speak.
or the Idols of the Cave, Travis, which dive into the idea that he gave, which consists of the conceptions of doctrines which are dear to the individual who cherishes them. So something that you can't really separate yourself with it because it's a part of you. And it's part of your human experience, right? And that's probably one of the harder things to distance yourself from because it's who you are. So without possessing any evidence of the truth, you know, you still hold on to the ideas of what you feel is right and what you think is true. Something that, you know, is a base instinct that maybe our Stone Age forefathers had, which really goes into the idea of idols of the cave, right?
I kind of see that as like, yeah, like my, like as part of your upbringing, like my parents said this and this and this, and so therefore I believe this and this and this, whether it's true or not. And it's kind of like, yeah, so you protect that belief. Somehow
it comes from education. Yeah. It comes from customs.
Exactly.
It comes from accidental or contingent experiences.
Mm-hmm. This is where you have some false conceptions that are based on other, like human communication, like human interaction, where it's just like through language, like with other humans, that it's hard to understand the exactness of something because we're stuck in a rut of expressing ourselves a certain way. So like the words, like we can only say certain words because we only have, or we can only say certain things because we only have certain words to describe them in a way. So we need to get rid of the idols of that.
Yeah.
You know, like we need to, basically what he's saying, we need to find new ways to express ourselves or new, you know, meaning, new words kind of thing.
Well, they always say, you know, the sense that you probably heard this before, that, you know, words are very clumsy things. You know, when you travel across the planet, you realize that there are some translations that just cannot be made from one language to the other to give you the idea of how clumsy language can be.
That's a great example.
Right?
Yeah. Yep. There's plenty of Czech examples out there. So, yeah. But, plenty of German ones where it's like, well, it doesn't quite mean the same thing, but basically, yeah. Or like, it's not word for word, but yeah. Another idol is the idol of the theater, which I kind of understand it as, again, kind of go, like it's the idols of our beliefs. Like just we're stuck in a rut from our traditional philosophical systems, which I think he meant as like medieval philosophical systems. Maybe like medieval, like religious thinking, that kind of thing, that we have this idols of the theater, these things that we, also publicly believe together kind of thing.
Well, I find this, I think you nailed it right on the head. I think this is actually, his sort of viewpoint of giving it to the church because basically, you know, I think, you know, the idea of following doctrine like sheep in his mind would be something that can keep you from questioning new things because it always was this way. It is this way and should always be this way is something he wants you to leave behind for destroying these idols. And the idols of the theater has to deal with groupthink. That's how I look at it, Travis, because you have groupthink here, just like you would be if you were sitting in a theater. You're all like having this communal experience, just like you would in a theater or a church. And he wants you to break away from that groupthink. So leave those idols of the theater behind.
Yeah, good. So out with the old. We get that. In with the new. Now, before we jump into all of his scientific theory and that kind of thing, and there's some neat things I want to point out with his atomic theory or his scientific theory, because in my mind, Francis Bacon is another great example of this in-between gap of old medieval thinking and new, like just like Isaac Newton. Like we don't, but not like this brand new atomic theory where we have this you know, oxygen and carbon and all of these are elements. Gold is an element, but he still had the old atomic theory. But Francis Bacon was still a bridge between the old and the new. And here, if you want to read a bunch of his kind of alchemical thoughts, you can find it on levity.com. There's a long text by Francis Bacon. I'll read you a piece from the unfinished Instauratio Magna, and he writes, quote, "The world hath been much abused by the opinion of making of gold. The work itself I judge to be possible, but the means hitherto propounded to effect it are, in the practice, full of error and imposture, and in the theory, full of unsound imaginations. For to say that nature hath an intention to make all metals gold, and that if she were delivered from impediance, she would perform her own work. And that work is capital, meaning the work of transmutation. And that if the crudities, impurities, and leprosities of metals were cured, they would become gold. And that a little quantity of the medicine in the work of projection will turn a sea of the baser metal into gold. By multiplying, all these are but dreams, and so are many other grounds of alchemy. So yeah, clearly, like, alchemy is possible. It's just very hard to do. He also, you can see here in this quote that he believed that if you remove the impurities, then it becomes gold. So the purest metal ripens to gold, just like Syndivogius, and, you know, we've mentioned that a dozen other times. And even, who was the basilisk? The basilisk guy, he also had the same theories. So yeah, so we do believe that, I mean, so he's aware of, like, normal alchemical theories and even, you know, mimics, like, echoes them in his own works. So it's just kind of neat that he also writes about purifying the spirit. That's why I said he could read more on levity.com. According to Bacon, man would be able to explain all the processes in nature if he could acquire full insight into the hidden structure and the secret workings of matter. So so he did believe in, you know, that it's possible to transmutate and conquer matter.
I think my favorite line in that quote you said, Travis, was the leprosities of metal were cured, you know, in the sense of, you know, saying, you know, being leprosy.
Yeah,
the leprosy of metals, basically.
I was like, he didn't quite understand what leprosy is, apparently. But yeah, like so to speak.
I think, you know, you see people kind of grasping in the dark for what they think they know in their current viewpoints on things. And mm-hmm. as we say, words are a very clumsy thing. But to the people reading his quote at the time, they say, oh, I get it. You know, there's an impurity of this metal that needs to be cured.
I didn't mention that, like, every single word in there is misspelled by modern terms. That was kind of challenging,
but challenging to read. Yes.
Yeah, but it makes sense. It's still understandable. But yeah, leprosities. Google wants to autocorrect that to something else. But yeah, neat quote. There is a lot more. I mean, he did write quite a bit about alchemy. So that's why he's on the show. But
and I think this is a really interesting point as we're coming up to this point of our discussion on Bacon, is that his notions of form is made possible by the integration into his matter theory, which ideally reduces the world of appearances to some minimal parts, accessible and open to manipulation by the knower or the maker. So I'll give you a quote to kind of maybe wrap your head around that. The fundamental research of Graham Rees has shown that Bacon's special mode of cosmology is deeply influenced by the magic of semi-Paracelsian doctrine. For Bacon, matter theory is the basic doctrine, not classical mechanics, as it is with Galileo. Consequently, Bacon's purified and modified versions of chemistry, alchemy, and physiology remain primary disciplines for his explanation of the world.
And I think it's like the way that we have modern chemistry to explore, you know, to find things out about the world. He believed the same thing with alchemy. So to him, it was just like, well, yeah, we can use alchemical means to discovery, for science. So in his world, it totally jived. Alchemy had nothing to do with supernatural or magic or anything. Transmutation is possible. So, you know, let's experiment with that. Let's see what else we can do with alchemical theory. So,
well, you know, and you mentioned magic, Travis. You know, for Bacon, magic is classified as applied science, while he generally subsumes that under science, quote unquote, pure sciences and technology can flourish. So it is never really identified with black magic, as we might think, since it represents the ultimate legitimate power over nature. Whereas magia was connected to crafts in the 16th and 17th centuries, Bacon's science remains the knowledge of forms in order for to transform them into operations. Really, again, wrap your head around this. We're talking the mid to late 17th century when witchcraft was just kicking it. I mean, it was, you know, for several hundred years, people were being burned at the stake for creating potions and conjuring spells on people all the way up into the 1690s at his fever pitch.
I kind of want to say Bacon's heart is in the right place. Like he believes in the principles of the scientific method. He's developing these principles. Like, he's one of the founders, let's say. However, he still assumes many weird things. So for him, he's like, well, if this magic spell works, sympathetic magic principles work, well, cool, let's use that for science. Let's figure out. He just assumes certain things, I would say. Not everything, not all experiments have been run yet. Not everything has been discovered yet in his lifetime. And so he gets certain things wrong, or we see things that with modern eyes is a little bit weird. And here's a great example I have of that, which there's some tables here which are like from his atomic theories. And this is really weird. Like, you'll have some pneumatic substances or sidereal fire planets substances, like, again, tables of ways of discovering the nature of matter, let's say. So how do you what is matter? And he has, like, on like one of the columns is named sulfur quaternion. And this one table is called the two quaternions, and we have sulfur quaternion, mercury quaternion, and then you look up between row 1, 2, 3, 4, and you have like pneumatic substances, and so you'll have terrestrial fire under sulfur quaternion, you'll have air under mercury quaternion. And it's just like how to categorize things. Like, what's the difference between air and fire? What's the difference between water? So oil and oily inflammable substances, terrestrial ones in parentheses, is, so the sulfur quaternion of that is water and crude non-inflammable substances. So yeah, it's just tables of like weird, like, aspects and intermediaries and that this is his theory of matter. So, but still, like, yeah, I mean, he was still in the generations that thought the stars were fixed. He's quantifying, he's classifying things. That's the interesting thing to note here. Yeah, and to read you a quote regarding these tables. Bacon writes, "It has not been ill-observed by the chemists in their triad of first principles that sulfur and mercury run through the whole universe." That's why sulfur and mercury are a column that cut through everything, okay? That you can classify everything in the world with sulfur and mercury, is what he's saying. Okay, and in these two, one of the most general consents in nature does seem to be observable, for there is a consent between sulfur, oil, and greasy exhalation. I mentioned oil, that was one of the columns that intersects with sulfur mercury, and exhalation, flame, and perhaps the body of a star. See, stars was in his tables. So there is between mercury, water, and watery vapors, air, and perhaps the pure and intersidereal ether. So yeah, like space, the ether. Yet these two quaternions, or great tribes of things, each within its own limits, differ immensely in quantity of matter and density, but agree very well in configuration. So that, and then you see his tables. So for tables of the two quaternions, those are the kind of things I described. At some point, I'll put them up on the website so you can see. It doesn't make a lot of sense to. There's not much you can glean from his tables, to be honest. But it does show that he believed everything is made out of, which is that's an alchemical theory, ladies and gentlemen. Everything is comprised of sulfur and mercury. That's alchemical thought. So so that's still, he was classifying things in an alchemical manner.
And that takes us, Travis, to the idea of, again, scientific method and how he kind of put his thoughts together from pen to paper. And one of the his main work that was done in 1620 was called The Great Instauration. And this great work remained a fragment, bits and pieces, since Bacon was only able to finish parts of the planned outline. The volume was introduced by an intro and then had a dedication to the king, King James I, of course, as a preface. And after that, Bacon printed the plan of the Instauratio before he turned to the strategy of his research program, which was known as the Novum Organum Scientiarum. So, Bacon organized his Instauratio in these pieces, and he divided it into six parts, Trav, and which reminded the contemporary readers of God's work in the 6 days of creation. So the plan of the work runs as follows, all right? The first chapter would be the divisions of the sciences. The second is known as the new organon, or the directions concerning the interpretation of nature itself. The third chapter falls along the lines of the phenomena of the universe, or the natural or experimental history for the foundation of philosophy. The fourth chapter finds us at the ladder of intellect. The fifth chapter is the forerunners, or the anticipations of the new philosophy, basically the new kids on the block with their new thought processes, right?
Yeah.
Right. You have to have, again, usher out the old and bring in the new. All right, that's chapter five. And then chapter six would be the new philosophy, or the active science that he was actually peddling at that point in the 1600s, right? So part one, he aimed at the distinction between what was already invented and known in contrast to the things omitted which ought to be there.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, now, I mean, basically this work, and again, it wasn't finished, but basically this work was like his philosophy of science, of the intellect, of, you know, it's a very big work and far-reaching kind of thing. In summary, Francis Bacon, who lived from 1561 to 1626, and the reason I mention that is that, yeah, the book we wrote is like, that's Rudolf II's time period. Rudolf II died a couple decades earlier, but this was before the 30 Years' War, this time when all our favorites are on the show. And he was, you know, Francis Bacon, the philosopher, the statesman and politician, the scientist, and of course, author, and then, you know, eventually Attorney General and Lord Chancellor and all that. In fact, for a while, the scientific method, like his specific method, was called the Baconian method, which was, you know, had an influence for a while. And, you know, now it's, I mean, because that's the thing, like the scientific method has been honed over time. He didn't invent it wholesale. He wasn't the only father of science or father of empiricism, but yeah, definitely one. And he died at the age of 65. He died of pneumonia from freezing chickens, like you said. And one last thing I want to mention is the man who epitomized the success of Bacon's inductive method, the scientific method, was born 9 months after Francis Bacon's death, namely Robert Boyle. And that is that's foreshadowing, because we'll do an episode on Robert Boyle soon. No, we already did, didn't we? Oh, I don't. Uh-oh.
I don't remember.
No, we did. Oh, we did Roger Bacon. Oh, boy, this is, yeah, we did Roger Bacon. And by the way, are you getting hungry from saying bacon so many times, or is that just me?
I'm not, because I'm so put off about the frozen chicken experiment.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That kind of threw me off there. But, you know, I will tell you, as we wrap up his life and talking about his viewpoints on things, his curriculum vitae is actually pretty darn amazing. You know, he was able to ingratiate himself into the court of King James I in the early 1600s. He was knighted. He was able to kind of to rub elbows with the who's who of the day, and then get kind of spit in their eye in a lot of ways, saying, "You know nothing, Jon Snow," because you're of the old guard and I'm of the new guard, and we're going to do things this way by deconstructing what we think we know and starting from ground zero and working our way up, and see if we can find something new in our new knowledge set by tearing down all our idols of our forefathers of science and thought. And some deep thoughts were put into this, but you know, his tail end of his life, like many of the folks we follow on the show, Travis, they wind up having a great deal of financial struggles. Either they go to bankruptcy, or they have some sort of scandal where they're just, you know, brought down to, you know, very human sort of base levels of trying to just eke out an existence after these great experiments and these great sort of thought that they would have for alchemical processes. But it does come to the idea that we're all fallible in a very human way, that it really lends credence to the fact that these guys were amazing when they were still healthy and financially sound, that they could make these great contributions to science and a chemical thought before it all kind of came tumbling down around them. He did get a book out, which was pretty informative with his 6 chapters. That's something that he'll be remembered by as well. But I think he had a wonderful life in this sense, and really gave great contributions to science.
And freezing chicken.
I guess pneumonia.
We'd also like to mention that the History of Alchemy podcast is an Agora Podcast Network member. This month, the podcast of the month is Elias Belhadad's The History of Islam, which I have listened to and I do highly recommend. And he and Elias also plugged us and Bohemican. So, Pete, you like him too. Shut up.
I do. I'll take it.
we're also a member of the Dark Myths Collective. And I bring up both of them because, well, first of all, we have to, but also because we were on, there is a Dark Myths podcast. Dark Myths has its own feed. And I talked to Christops from the Eastern Border and the Lesser Bonapartes for the Dark Myths there. So you can go to iTunes and look up Dark Myths. And also, likewise, Pete and I were on the Agora Exchange. And so the Agora also has its own feed. And I think it's cool that these networks are doing this, because I learned a lot about our fellow colleagues, basically, because you get a behind the scenes glimpse of who we are and what else we do besides talk about the Czech Republic and alchemy. And also, I'd like to mention that I just started a new podcast. What? Called Africa, A History. And you can find that and a link to all of our shows, including Bohemican with Pete and I, and A History of Germany and The Secret Cabinet. All of those are under podcastnik.com. That's podcastnik.com. And And then for Bohemican, real quick, because I don't want to give too many plugs, but we did something very awesome, and that is what did we do?
We reached over 100,000 downloads just recently. So we are in a
That is true. That's a sign of how awesome we are for Bohemican.
That's the thing on top of my head.
Altogether, we're millionaires. But no, but I meant the latest Bohemican show we recorded.
Oh, that's right. We actually went in the opening night here in Czech Republic to the movie Anthropoid that did very well in the United States early this summer. It was actually released a little later in the year here in September. And we did a review for that movie about Operation Anthropoid and the assassination of Heydrich.
Worst Nazi ever.
Yeah, Reinhard Heydrich, and the assassination took very, very small part of that story. It was more about the ramifications of the 5,000 plus people that had to pay the price in Czechoslovakia for that assassination.
This is actually now our second episode on that topic, and it's because we've been to where villages used to be, because there was 2 villages that were wiped out. In retribution, trying to find
Lidice being probably the more well-known of the two. And of course, as it touches upon in this movie, that the people, no matter how much they helped the paratroopers, the Czech paratroopers that came in for the assassination attempt or not, anybody that came in contact with them that were linked to them somehow, they all died. They were all either sent to concentration camps or were shot on the spot.
But still, they killed the worst Nazi of all time. So kind of. Anyways, enough about that, because that's our second episode on that now in Bohemican, because it is a really interesting topic, especially if you like World War II history. So yeah, go take a look at those. And otherwise, thank you very much for listening.
Take care.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.